From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The plan isn't perfect, but it's a strong bill, and it is a worthy solution. Only a bipartisan bill will become law, and I believe we owe it to the American people to stop talking about immigration and start acting.
A bipartisan group of senators has reached an agreement to overhaul the nation's immigration laws, but a number of immigrant rights groups say it's unacceptable. We'll talk with the Asian American Legal Defense Fund. But first, a pivotal hearing for the imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll speak with his lead attorney, Robert Bryant. Plus, British journalist and environmentalist George Monbiot on Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning.
To have a high chance of preventing runaway climate change, we need a 90% cut in carbon emissions by 2030. I think I've shown how that can be done without bringing industrial civilization to an end.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A bipartisan group of senators has proposed sweeping changes to the nation's immigration laws. The Senate bill calls for increased security on the U.S.-Mexican border, the hiring of 18,000 more border agents, and new requirements for employers to check the immigration status of employees. The bill would also allow undocumented immigrants living in the United States to continue to work here if they fulfill a number of requirements, including paying a $5,000 fine and getting a biometric identification card. The bill would also set up a point system to determine who merits a new type of work visa. Details about the point system are still being negotiated, but the White House has suggested immigrants should be able to earn points by serving in the U.S. military. The Senate proposal would also allow up to 600,000 temporary workers to come to the United States each year. Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts spoke at a news conference Thursday announcing the bill.
This plan isn't perfect, but it's a strong bill, and it is a worthy solution. Only a bipartisan bill will become law, and I believe we owe it to the American people to stop talking about immigration and start acting. We owe it to them to solve this crisis in a way that upholds our humanity and our tradition of a nation of immigrants.
Several Republicans, including President Bush, voiced support for the deal. However, many immigrant rights advocates have expressed concern. Democratic Congressmember Xavier Becerra of California said the proposal would create a permanent underclass of immigrant workers. He also criticized the bill because it marks a major departure from the country's historic policy of giving preference to family members of immigrants already living in the United States. Democratic Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey criticized the plan for the prohibitive fees that immigrants must pay to gain legal status. Several Republicans condemned the bill, saying it gives amnesty to undocumented immigrants. Israeli airstrikes in Gaza have killed at least 10 Palestinians over the past 24 hours. In the biggest raid, an Israeli bomb destroyed a two-story building belonging to Hamas. The bomb killed two members of Hamas and wounded 45 people, including civilians who were buried in the rubble. Five more Palestinians died when Israeli warplanes bombed a Hamas headquarters building east of Gaza City. A third Israeli airstrike targeted a pickup truck near the southern town of Rafah. It killed three people, a father and his two teenage sons. Israeli troops and tanks have also moved across the Gaza border. Hamas accused Israel of colluding with Fatah in a battle for dominance over Gaza. A spokesperson for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said the Israeli attacks were justified because Hamas is firing rockets into southern Israel.
We won't allow them to use their violence, their terror against Israel. Israel knows how to respond. We will do all defensive measures to be sure that our citizens are safe. We will not be dragged by the Hamas into the mire of Gaza.
Hamas has vowed to keep carrying out rocket attacks. Paramedics in Israel said at least three Israelis were injured this morning in a rocket attack on the town of Sderot. On Thursday, Hamas rockets hit a synagogue and a school. This is Hamas spokesperson Ayman Taha.
We will not be quiet for long with these continued crimes, and we will not stand with our hands tied. We're ready to launch any type of attack by any means and equipment necessary, and in all the cities, we will choose the right time and place.
In Washington, D.C., the Bush administration has praised Israel for showing what it described as, quote, great restraint. But the Arab League has denounced Israel for exploiting Palestinian infighting. World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz has announced he will resign at the end of June. Calls for his resignation have been mounting since it was disclosed he oversaw a pay raise and promotion for his companion, Shaha Ali Risa. The White House said it will soon announce a candidate to replace Wolfowitz. Although over 180 countries are involved in the World Bank, the United States traditionally picks the bank's president. Critics of the World Bank have warned Wolfowitz's personnel dispute should not overshadow more systemic problems at the bank. In Iraq, the British think tank is warning that the Iraqi government has lost control of vast areas of the country and is on the verge of collapse. The report by Chatham House warns, quote, it is now possible to argue that Iraq is on the verge of being a failed state, which faces the distinct possibility of collapse and fragmentation. The report also concludes several civil wars are now being fought in Iraq. May 20th marks the first anniversary of the formation of the Maliki government. In other Iraq news, two broadcast journalists working for ABC News have been killed. ABC cameraman Ala al-Din Aziz and soundman Saif Laith Yusuf were killed when unknown assailants attacked their car on Thursday. Meanwhile, the Iraqi city of Samarra remains under curfew for an 11th day. Residents are struggling to find fuel, food, and medication as vehicles have been restricted from entering or leaving the city. The Iraqi government imposed the curfew on May 6 after a suicide car bombing killed 12 police officers, including Samarra's police chief. Residents say the situation in the city is dire.
The bridge has been closed. There is no electricity. There is no water. We are suffering. The sick people cannot leave. They died in their homes because ambulances cannot reach them. How long will this situation last?
A doctor working in Samarra's main hospital said 10 people, including 7 infants, had died because of a lack of fuel to power generators and operate life-saving equipment. In Washington, Tony Blair met with President Bush on Wednesday for what was likely his last visit to the White House as British Prime Minister. Blair defended his decision to back the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq.
You know, this is not it's not about us remaining true to the course that we've set out because of the alliance with America. It is about us remaining steadfast because what we are fighting, the enemy we are fighting, is an enemy that is aiming its destruction at our way of life and anybody who wants that way of life.
In news from Capitol Hill, a group of Democrats are pushing for the Senate to hold a no-confidence vote next week for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Gonzalez has been widely criticized for his role in the politicization of the Justice Department, as well as the administration's warrantless surveillance program. On Thursday, President Bush refused to answer questions about whether he ordered personally Gonzalez in 2004 to try to coerce then-Attorney General John Ashcroft to sign off on the spy program.
Sir, did you send your then-chief of staff and White House counsel to the bedside of John Ashcroft while he was ill to get him to approve that program? And do you believe that kind of conduct from White House officials is appropriate?
Kelly, there's a lot of speculation about what happened and what didn't happen. I'm not going to talk about it.
In other news from Capitol Hill, the House has voted to demand the Bush administration begin the task of closing the military base at Guantanamo. Meanwhile, a Navy lawyer has been found guilty of illegally leaking information about prisoners there. In 2005, Lieutenant Commander Matthew Diaz mailed the names of 550 Guantanamo detainees at Guantanamo to an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Diaz faces up to 14 years in jail. In Philadelphia, attorneys from Mumia Abu-Jamal argued before a federal appeals court Thursday that the former Black Panther deserves a new trial. Abu-Jamal has been on death row for a quarter of a century after being convicted of killing a police officer following a controversial trial. The appeals court will decide whether Mumia Abu-Jamal gets a new trial, life in prison without parole or execution. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Protests are continuing at the University of Massachusetts Amherst over the school's decision to grant President Bush's former White House Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, an honorary degree. Meanwhile, at Harvard University, students have begun a campaign to condemn the presence of Israel's former military chief, Dan Chalutz, on the campus. Chalutz is being sponsored by the Israeli Army to attend a two-month executive training program at Harvard's Business School. Posters have been put up around campus that read, "Wanted for Crimes of War." Dan Chalutz served as the head of Israel's military during last year's war against Lebanon. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. For our first segment, we turn to Philadelphia and a pivotal court hearing for the imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Abu-Jamal has spent a quarter century on death row. He was convicted of killing a police officer following a controversial trial before a predominantly white jury. In 2001, a judge overturned Mumia Abu-Jamal's death sentence, but upheld his conviction. On Thursday, a three-judge panel heard oral arguments to decide whether Mumia gets a new trial, life in prison without parole, or execution. Hundreds of people packed the courtroom, while an even larger crowd rallied in support of Mumia outside. A decision may not come down for months.
We're joined right now by Mumia Abu-Jamal's lead attorney. Robert Bryan has represented Mumia since 2003. He's a fellow of the American Board of Criminal Lawyers and the former chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Welcome to Democracy
Now! It's a pleasure to be here, Amy.
Why don't you lay out what happened in the courtroom for, what was it, 2 hours yesterday?
Well, it was over 2 hours. We argued before a three-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which is just below the U.S. Supreme Court. The court seemed really interested. There are a number of issues pending before this court. They involve the death penalty, racism in jury selection, the racism and bias of the trial judge, Sabo, who referred to my client during the trial to use his words. I'm quoting him. I'm going to help them fry the nigger, referring to Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Who heard that?
Pardon?
Who heard that?
A court stenographer. It was just outside the courtroom. She was going with her judge to another courtroom, and they passed Judge Sabo in an antechamber adjacent to the courtroom where the trial occurred, and Sabo started talking about the trial and made those comments, which are as offensive as... I mean, I specialize in death penalty litigation. I've handled hundreds of death penalty trials and cases in post-conviction proceedings in the past three decades. I even once spent 3 days in jail in a murder case for contempt of court in which my client was acquitted, African-American. I've seen a lot of racism, but I've never heard anything like that except in this case in Philadelphia. It's unprecedented.
And that court stenographer's statement, has it ever gone before a judge or on this case?
Juan, it went before the court yesterday. I said, from my lips, and I said, understand, these are the words of Judge Sabo, not Robert R. Bryan. Mm-hmm. But our focus yesterday is interesting. With all the energy by the prosecution to kill my client, the focus yesterday was on constitutional crimes committed by the prosecution. What the whole focus was primarily was on the death penalty, I'd say 20% and 80% on racism in the district attorney's office of Philadelphia. And in all of my years of doing this kind of work, I find yesterday's hearing, as I think back on it this morning, as unprecedented. These judges, how they'll rule, we do not know, but they were very troubled. That was very clear about the racism in this case.
One of the main points that you were raising was the jury selection process in the original trial, right?
Yes.
The number of challenges of potential white jurors versus black jurors. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, yes. The U.S. Supreme Court has been very clear in recent years, beginning with the 1986 decision, that racism in jury selection offends the U.S. Constitution. And in this case, the prosecutor used over two-thirds of his strikes to remove people of color, African-Americans, only 20 to 25% white people. I mean, you know, you have all of these African-American people removed and very few white people. And it's well documented that the District Attorney's Office of Philadelphia, during that period in the early 80s, and certainly going back, were very active in employing racism in jury selection, discrimination. And the big question yesterday, in my words, was, the issue for the court was, and is, was discrimination at work in this case? And it seems like not only the statistics, But a wealth of other evidence certainly seems to establish that. Let's just hope that the judges agree with us.
Robert Bryan, the Assistant District Attorney Hugh Burns told the appellate panel that Judge William Yon erred when he overturned Abu-Jamal's death sentence because he should have deferred to the decision of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which had already held that the penalty phase jury instructions were not confusing. Please explain that, because right. most people think Mumia Abu-Jamal remains on death row.
All right, that is true. He is still on death row. He's in a cell today, Amy, that's smaller than most of our bathrooms at home. And from there, he does his journalism, which is another story, and it's phenomenal. But the lower U.S. District Court reversed the case in December 2001 because of misuse of the death penalty by Judge Sable, the trial judge. He instructed the jury that they could not return anything less than death unless they all agreed on any one particular special circumstance, such as his good works in his life. In other words, you couldn't have one juror feel that he should not get death for one reason, another, a different reason. They had to all agree, which is nonsense and contrary to U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Immediately after that decision, he reversed it. In other words, he said there had to be a new trial on the question of life or death, a new jury trial. The prosecution immediately appealed it, so thus the death penalty remained in effect. Mumia remains on death row, where he sits today as we're here in this nice studio. And the court started out yesterday just ripping into the prosecutor. He had the opening comments because he's the one who initially appealed, then we cross-appealed. And they just could not understand how one could logically find that what the judge did in this case in instructing the jury would pass muster with the U.S. Constitution. So the court seemed very troubled by that. What we're interested in are the other issues. Of course, I do not want my client to be executed. I do not want to have to go and watch my friend who first asked me to represent him in 1986, 21 years ago. I do not want to lose him. But I want a new trial for him. And at that trial, I've won countless murder cases through the years. This case deserves an acquittal. I want him to go home to his family.
Now, in terms of the move from here, the court, are you expect a decision sometime in the next few months?
Yes, and there's really no way of predicting. I could only give a guesstimate, not even an estimate. Yeah. I would predict that we would probably have a decision in 45 to 90 days. Now, I just received an email last evening from the court, which is, I've never had this happen in the hundreds of death penalty cases I've handled through the years, in which they want us now to order transcripts of the hearing. Now, this isn't a trial. This is before a U.S. Court of Appeals three-judge panel. And so I will deal with that later today. So they will actually want transcribed. I don't know why they'd want to hear, read what I have to say, but maybe my associates, maybe they want to see what they had to say, but they want transcripts of the hearing, which is unusual in a case at this stage.
And it was also unusual that they allowed the NAACP to actually argue.
One of the first things I did even though Mumia started asked me to represent him in 1986, and I turned him down, I was just too busy with other cases. When I finally took over the case, he came back to me 4.5 or 5 years ago. One of the first things I did was I started talking with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund here in New York because they are very well known for their great work, in particularly in racism and jury selection, which is one of our big issues. And so they argued, Christina Swarns of that office argued yesterday. I shared somewhere, and I was able to persuade the court. I filed a motion asking that they be able to share some of my argument time. Normally, what they would call amicus curiae, friend of the court people, organizations like the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, only submit briefs. I asked the court if they could also join me in argument, and the court granted it, which was wonderful. And so I was up arguing, then and my associate Judith Ritter, who's a law professor, argued. And she argued strictly on the death penalty issue. And then the NAACP Legal Defense Fund was able to argue, and then I wrapped up. I argued twice. But it was marvelous to have them join us. So I think it indicates the concern this court has. They seem to be trying to grapple with trying to do the right thing. Only time will tell. But also the National Lawyers Guild filed an amicus curiae brief. They did not argue yesterday because we just didn't have enough time.
Ed Rendell, the governor of Pennsylvania, was the DA at the time, 1982, yes. when Mumia Abu-Jamal was tried. His wife is a judge on the Third Circuit.
But she recused herself, disqualified herself. She does in every case out of Philadelphia, so that was a non-issue. The prosecution tried to use that red herring to get rid of this court. And of course, the court slapped them down and rejected that. She always steps aside in these type of cases.
Mumia Abu-Jamal was not at the hearing yesterday.
No, unfortunately, because it wasn't a trial.
How is he doing?
I talked with him at length, Amy, last night, and he was very humble about what happened yesterday. And his comments to me, and incidentally, he wanted me to say hello to both of you this morning. His comments to me was, you know, what I want, Robert, people understand this is not about me. Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is about everybody on death row around the world. This is about all political prisoners around the world. And I hope that through what the court does in this case, it will help other people. It's a typical Mumia comment and attitude, and it's he's very humble about his position in this.
And also, for some of our listeners or viewers who may not be as familiar with Mumia's case, how would you estimate the impact of his case, given the virtual blackout that you have in the commercial media of the Mumia Abu-Jamal case? What is the impact of this case around the world?
Well, the impact in commercial media, as we're speaking today, has been shifting and changing. I've worked hard to try to bring it to everybody, the message in this case. But it's a worldwide issue, Mumia Abu-Jamal. I've given a number of talks in Paris, in various places in France. I spoke to 2,500 people in January in Berlin, Germany. And there's world interest, standing ovation at the end of all of these talks. And it's not about me. It's not about Mumia, as he keeps reminding me. It's about him as a symbol in the fight against the death penalty. And you have to remember that he's unique in the world, because Mumia Abu-Jamal is not just a death row prisoner, a brilliant one at that, but he is a journalist. When he was arrested, he was already known as the voice of the voiceless. And he continues from this tiny bathroom-sized cell to turn out weekly these commentaries that are read and heard by people, not only here, but around the world. And there's nothing like what's happening with Mumia around the world. So he's important to people everywhere.
Robert Bryan, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Robert Bryan is the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal, fellow of the American Board of Criminal Lawyers, former chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And we will certainly continue to follow this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, George Monbiot on global warming. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting in over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV stations and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. Juan?
Well, every week seems to bring new warnings on the consequences of rising global temperatures caused by human activity. A new report from the British charity Christian Aid predicts global warming will create up to 1 billion refugees by the year 2050. The World Health Organization recently said it expects deaths and injuries from climate change to more than double in the next 25 years. The yearly death toll linked to weather patterns is forecast to top 300,000 by the year 2030.
The UN-sponsored Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change declared earlier this year the warming of the Earth's climate system an unequivocal and attributable to human activities. The panel's called for humans to make sweeping cuts in greenhouse gas emissions over the next 50 years to keep global warming in check. The Bush administration's stance is well known. President Bush laid out his opposition to the Kyoto Accords in his first State of the Union address in 2001.
Kyoto is in many ways unrealistic. Many countries cannot meet their Kyoto targets. The targets themselves were arbitrary and not based upon science.
Global warming is being pushed as a major issue for the next month's gathering of world leaders at the G8 summit in Germany. The Washington Post reported this week the Bush administration's trying to weaken the proposed climate change declaration. U.S. negotiators want to delete a pledge to limit the global temperature rise and cut emissions of greenhouse gas to half 1990 levels. Administration also wants to strike language that designates the U.N. as the appropriate forum for negotiating action on climate change. Our next guest has done a detailed study into what it would practically take to heed the warnings on climate change and reduce emissions of greenhouse gas. George Monbiot is a widely read columnist for The Guardian of London, a leading British campaigner for the environment. His latest book is called Heat: How to Stop the Planet from Burning. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
How do you stop the planet from burning?
Well, for a start, we have to recognize the extraordinary scale of the challenge we face. In order to prevent runaway climate change, in other words, climate change that we can no longer do anything about, we need a cut in greenhouse gas emissions of roughly 60% worldwide, which means about 90% in the rich nations by 2030. And what I've done is to look sector by sector at all the parts of the economy to see how that cut could best be made without bringing industrial civilization crashing down. And I think that it can be made. It can be made without a major impact on our quality of life. The technology is there already, the economic potential is there already. What is lacking is the political will.
Now, you mentioned in your book that even those countries that are supposedly most advanced in this, Britain and some of the other countries in Europe in terms of their goals, are still way below what they need to be in terms of national goals to be anywhere close to achieving a rollback in greenhouse emissions.
That's correct. And what we see now, even in the most progressive governments as far as climate change is concerned, is that they're giving up on the key climate change target, which is preventing global temperatures from rising by more than 2 degrees centigrade, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, above their pre-industrial level. Now, this is a critical target because if you get beyond that point, that's when the positive feedbacks start to begin. That's when the biosphere, the world's natural systems, begins to produce far more carbon dioxide, far more methane. It begins to absorb less of the carbon dioxide which we produce. And that is a point beyond which we can't do anything more about it. 2 degrees of global warming centigrade leads automatically to 3 degrees because of positive feedbacks. 3 degrees leads automatically to 4 degrees. Once we get to that point, we wash our hands of it. There's nothing more we can do. So we must not get to that point. That is a critical thing. We can't allow 2 degrees centigrade of warming to happen. To have a high chance of preventing that from happening requires a 60% global cut in carbon emissions by 2030.
I want to ask you about the so-called debate over global warming. Here in the United States, one of the leading opponents of global warming is the Oklahoma Republican Senator James Inhofe. He spoke at a hearing featuring former Vice President Al Gore this past March.
When I talk about skeptics, I'm talking about scientists who believe that the science is not settled. When I talk about alarmists, I'm saying they're the ones who think that it is settled, okay? When the debate is balanced, the skeptics win, the alarmists lose. In New York last week, a major debate took place to examine whether, this is the goal, whether global warming is a crisis. Prior to the debate, the hand-wringers, the alarmists, your guys in the audience, outnumbered those who didn't think it was a crisis by 2-1. After the debate, it completely reversed. Now, that shift mirrors a larger one taking place in the scientific community.
Senator James Inhofe, your response, George Monbiot.
Could you find out what that guy's on? Because I want some. He's living in a dream world. And what he has done is what all unscientific critics of climate change do, which is to cherry-pick his data and cherry-pick his experts. He has plucked out of the vast range of scientific studies that tiny handful which might cast some doubt on climate change. He has plucked out of the vast range of climate scientists the tiny handful, most of whom are funded by Exxon and the other fossil fuel companies, which say that it's not happening. That is the opposite of the scientific process. The scientific process reviews the science as a whole and looks at all the studies, looks at all the scientists, and says the overwhelming consensus of the climate science is that man-made climate change is taking place, it presents a major threat to life on Earth, and we need to do something about it. To sustain his position, you must blinker yourself to the great majority of what is going on within the scientific community and look at the world like this.
Well, let's talk about your plan for being able to cut in the industrial countries that 90% of energy use. How would that, occur concretely in, for instance, in the United States or England without, as you say, having a collapse of the economies?
Okay, well, let's take surface transport as an example. And there's huge potential here. Number one, for boosting the fuel economy of cars 5 or 10-fold. At the moment, in the United States, the average fuel economy of cars is just over 21 miles per gallon. The Model T Ford in 1908 did 25 miles to the gallon. This country has gone backwards in terms of fuel economy, and yet the technological potential is absolutely vast. But you can go even further than that. If we still stick with cars for just a moment...
So by you saying 5 to 10-fold, you're talking about 100 miles to the gallon.
100 miles to the gallon, 150 miles to the gallon. It is not difficult, even given current technologies. The potential is right here in front of us. We just need to grasp it. You can go even further than that. Picture this scenario. The electric car, we all know the electric car works. There's plenty of models out there. The problem is that you can't go very far with it without having to plug it in again and wait 8 hours for the battery to recharge. But what if you don't have to do that? What if instead you pull into a filling station, you lift up the hood, crane comes over, lifts out the battery, drops in another one, and off you go again? What you do in that situation is to lease your battery from a network of filling stations. You just pay for the electricity, and it takes no more time to change it than it would take to fill up your tank with gas. There you see the potential. Even if we stick with cars, before we even look at public transport and the huge capacity there is there for greatly reducing carbon emissions, even if you stick with cars, you see this tremendous potential for cutting by 90 to 95% the emissions which they currently produce.
I wanted to talk about the role of hybrid vehicles, biofuels. In this year's State of the Union address, President Bush called for more investment into ethanol.
We need to press on with battery research for plug-in and hybrid vehicles and expand the use of clean diesel vehicles and biodiesel fuel. We must continue investing in new methods of producing ethanol. Using everything from wood chips to grasses to agricultural wastes.
President Bush, George Monbiot.
This is a total disaster. And the reason it is a disaster is twofold. Number one, you set up a competition between feeding people and feeding cars because you're producing those crops for biofuel on the same arable land which is currently being used to feed people. That competition will necessarily be won by the car drivers. The reason for that is that, by definition, those who are rich enough to run cars are richer than those who are in danger of dying of starvation. Already, with far less than 1% of the world's transport fuel coming from biofuel, we've seen a doubling in the price of corn and a near doubling in the price of wheat. And this is having an impact on people all over the world. The second reason why it's a disaster is that much of the new planting of biofuel is taking place on rainforest land or land which had other high carbon crops on it. And what we are seeing there is a massive impact, not just on biodiversity and on local habitat and environment, but also on climate change. In Malaysia and Indonesia now, the planting of palm oil for the biofuel market is the primary cause of deforestation. And one recent study shows that because you are cutting down tropical forest in order to plant it and draining peaty soils in order to plant it, every barrel of palm oil produces up to 10 times as much carbon dioxide as a barrel of gasoline. Palm oil and most of the biofuels are actually worse for the planet than petroleum.
And you're raising another point in this again, is that the impact of global warming is being felt most of all, and even the attempts to deal with it are being felt most in the poorest countries, so Bangladesh and others, who are already feeling enormous impacts from it as well.
This is a great paradox and cruelty of climate change, that those countries which are most responsible for it, the rich nations, most of which are in temperate parts of the world, are those which are going to be hit last by it and hit least by it. Countries which are least responsible for it, in Africa, in South Asia, for example, are already being hit by it and will be hammered by climate change. Ours is primarily a moral responsibility. I'm not just appealing to people's self-interest here. This is the great moral issue of the 21st century. And if we don't deal with climate change, we condemn hundreds of millions of people to death. And this is the peculiar moral challenge of it, that it requires a complete reorientation of our moral compass, because things that were previously seen as good or innocent or morally neutral suddenly also turn out to be morally bad. Switching on the lights, taking the kids to school, whatever it might be, these things were good. Nobody had any doubts that it was fine to do all that. Now, well, obviously, we need to still switch on the lights, we need to still take the kids to school, but we must do it by means which does not condemn other people to death.
Condemn people to death. These are strong words. How do they die?
In Ethiopia already, with just, 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit of global warming, the short rains have been failing year after year now for the past 4 or 5 years. And they have been failing because of rising sea surface temperatures in the Indian Ocean. When the short rains fail, the yields of crops decline. When in a place like Ethiopia, where people are living very close to the edge already, yields of crops decline, people go hungry. People die of malnutrition-related diseases, or they simply die of starvation. If that is rolled out worldwide, which with roughly 4 degrees centigrade of warming, which is, 6, 7 degrees Fahrenheit of warming, we could see structural global famine. That means that even in a normal year, normal year's harvest, there will not be enough food produced to keep everybody in the world well fed. If that happens, the consequences are unimaginable, almost indescribable.
George Monbiot, to the issue of government interference in climate change. Earlier this year, here in the United States, a House committee released documents that showed hundreds of instances in which a former oil industry lobbyist edited government climate reports to play up uncertainty of a human role in global warming or play down evidence of such a role. The official, Philip Cooney, served as President Bush's chief of staff of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Prior to working in the White House, Cooney served as a lobbyist for the American Petroleum Institute, the largest oil lobby based in Washington, D.C. He now works for ExxonMobil. Cooney was questioned at a House oversight hearing by Democratic Congressmember Peter Welch.
And you have now edited that report to undercut the conclusion on climate warming that was reached by our scientists. Yes or no?
No, Congressman, I didn't edit the report. I made recommendations within an established interagency review process, and I believed at the time that I made them that I had a foundation for my comments based in the National Academy of Sciences. I'm not being lawyerly. I am reading the direct scientific quotations.
You did have a foundation, and it was admirable loyalty to the person who had appointed you to a political position.
Several government scientists have come forward with allegations of government interference in their work. This is Rick Plitz, formerly the U.S. Climate Change Science Program.
It wasn't just one thing. There were many things. It was an accumulation of things. They would ignore a report, they would edit a report, they would misrepresent a report, they would keep one scientist from talking to the press but put another one forward, they would take a website down. There were so many different aspects of this that it all just kind of added up.
Rick Piltz, a former U.S. climate scientist here in the United States, George Monbiot.
The Bush administration's handling of climate change is like Trofim Lysenko's handling of genetics. I mean, this is a complete clampdown on science, allied to a clampdown on democracy, and the two things often go hand in hand. It has been a story of fraud, of deception, of obfuscation, of lies. And the moment you start getting industry lobbyists with no scientific background, Cooney was a lawyer, to start editing scientific reports, you have stepped into the territory normally occupied by dictatorships.
What about the prior administration, the Clinton-Gore administration? Al Gore now, of course, is a virtual folk hero of those who support moving forward in a much more broad way on climate change, climate control. What did they do when they were in office?
Have you ever noticed how much better people are at governance once they're out of office? I mean, with Gore and Clinton, it was just a series of massive missed opportunities. They knew what they had to do, but they just didn't do it. And it has to be said that Gore's speech at the Kyoto conference in 1997 was one of the most disgraceful pieces of international diplomacy I've ever come across. George Bush could have made that speech. It was just full of deliberate confusions and evasions and elisions about what needed to be done about climate change. And I'm afraid to say that the Clinton-Gore administration in some ways did more harm than the Bush administration, because while Bush has gutted the US response to climate change, Gore and Clinton gutted the international response to climate change. They made sure that the Kyoto Protocol was pretty well a dead letter. They destroyed it as an effective instrument, and so they destroyed it for everyone.
George Monbiot, on the issue of the a speech you recently gave, where you talked about the axis of evil, George Bush, John Howard of Australia, and Stephen Harper of Canada.
Yes, the axis of evil on climate change. These guys have got together to make sure that there is no effective international action now taken on climate change. Okay, there wasn't any being taken anyway, partly because of the US gutting of the Kyoto Protocol before, but
they... Warren Clinton got it.
Well, it has to be said that, of course, they were being pushed very hard by Congress and by powerful industrial interests. So I can't blame them entirely for what happened. But they introduced all these caveats and clauses and these get-out clauses, things like the Clean Development Mechanism, which said you don't have to change your carbon emissions at home, you just pay somebody else to do it. And they played up to the other nations which didn't want to make serious commitments, and they made sure that even if Kyoto were to be implemented fully, which is not being implemented fully, it wouldn't make any really significant difference to cutting carbon emissions. They knew that you had to go much, much further than Kyoto went if we were to have that cut, and knowing that, they didn't push it in the direction it needed to be going. In fact, they held it back.
I'd like to ask you about China. Clearly, the Chinese take a position, hey, you folks in the industrial world have to first get your house in order before you tell us about getting our house in order. But on the other hand, China right now is the manufacturing center for the industrial world, in essence, in terms of the amount of increased industrialization going on there. What's going to happen, and what do you think needs to happen in terms of negotiations with China over climate change?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, before we point the finger at China, just bear in mind that the average emissions of carbon dioxide per person in China are 2.7 tonnes per year. In the United States, they're 20 tonnes per year. So it would be the height of hypocrisy to say it's those damn Chinese who are responsible for this problem. So saying, China is rapidly emerging as an enormous emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. It's rising very fast, and it will overtake the United States probably in November this year. as the world's primary emitter. So there's no question that it needs to be brought in to an international mechanism to cut those greenhouse gas emissions, and that it has to be brought in as an equal, not as a country which is told what to do by other countries, but as an equal partner in the development of a foundation for cutting climate change which is actually going to work. The first thing that needs to happen, if that is to take place, is for the rich nations, which have already enjoyed the benefits of the massive use of fossil fuels, to show that they are serious about cutting their contribution to carbon to carbon emissions. Otherwise, China just turns around and says, well, you've had your fun. What about us? Why can't we have ours? And it's absolutely essential that what is done now is that we break this perfect circle of finger-pointing, where the North Americans point to China and say, we can't do anything, it's those guys over there who are causing the problem, and China points to North America and say, we can't do anything either, it's those guys who are causing the problem. That's what they're both saying at the moment, and we need to break that, and we can only break that through international leadership shown by the United States, by Europe, by the other developed regions of the world.
George Monbiot, what has to happen at the G8 meeting in Germany?
We have to establish there a target for cutting carbon emissions which actually reflects what the science says rather than what the politics say. It doesn't matter what the politicians say about what can and can't be done. The atmosphere doesn't care about that. As far as the atmosphere is concerned, it's not concerned. It's a collection of gases. And all if all they're going to do is add to that gas by spouting off a lot of hot air, it's not going to deal with the problem. They have to look at what the scientists are saying about the cut which is required, and they have to then establish that as their target. By 2030, a 60% global cut.
If Americans care, what are three things they can do right now?
The first thing is to see yourself primarily as a citizen, not as a consumer. We're not going to solve this problem simply by consuming better. We have to solve it through political lobbying. We have to solve it through demanding that our governments set the right targets and then implement those targets. The second thing is to concentrate on particular areas which are of special interest to you. So we need dedicated campaigns on transport. We need dedicated campaigns on making houses more energy efficient. We need dedicated campaigns on reducing the amount of airport space given over to aeroplanes so that we actually cut the amount of aviation. That I'm afraid, is an essential if we're going to deal with climate change. It's moves like that which will make all the difference, and it has to happen here. Until the United States enters this race, until the United States gets serious about cutting greenhouse gas emissions, the world is stuck. We just cannot move on. This is the economic and the technological, indeed, and the political powerhouse of the world. And when the US steps in, things will happen very quickly indeed. Look at what happened when the United States joined the Second World War. It turned the whole economy around on a dime. Within 90 days, under pressure from the US government, your motor manufacturers were turning out fighter planes, having never looked at a fighter plane before, never designed one, never tested one, never prototyped one, anything. They were turning out fighter planes. They turned the whole thing around. That's because of the economic and technological dynamism that the United States has. That was in 1941. Think of what you could do now. Think of how you could turn this issue around.
George Monbiot, I want to thank you very much for being with us. George Monbiot, columnist for the London Guardian. His new book is Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
No,
thanks very
no
much.
There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather. Since my man and I ain't together, keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere, stormy weather. Just can't get my poor self together. so weary all the time. When he went away.
Billie Holiday, Stormy Weather. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
A bipartisan group of senators has proposed sweeping changes to the nation's immigration laws. The bill calls for increased security on the U.S.-Mexican border, the hiring of 18,000 more border agents, and new requirements for employers to check the immigration status of employees. The bill would allow undocumented immigrants to continue to work here if they fulfill a number of requirements, including paying a $5,000 fine, getting a biometric identification card. The bill would also set up a point system to determine who merits a new type of visa. The Senate proposal would also allow up to 600,000 temporary workers to come to the United States each year.
Democratic leaders are calling the bill a compromise reached under difficult political circumstances. Several Republicans, including President Bush, have voiced support for the measure. However, many immigrant rights advocates are expressing concern. Some say the proposal would create a permanent underclass of immigrant workers. We're joined now by Stan Mark, Program Director of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Explain exactly the proposal as you see it and why you're so concerned about it.
I think it's a radical departure from the current system that uses family reunification as the cornerstone of immigration policy. It moves us away from equal rights for all working people and undermines the rights of citizens, lawful permanent residents, as well as people who are trying to get legal status. The citizens under current law can petition for their sons and daughters, as well as married or unmarried, as well as people who are lawful permanent residents. This proposal eliminates those family preferences and undercuts family reunification policy as the cornerstone, replaces it, in effect, with a flow of immigrant workers in the future of the number that Juan said, 600,000 per year, which would be people who would be part of a new underclass, people who would have less rights, less protections, would be subjected to downgrading wages and working conditions, and another bracero program similar to the ones in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that was characterized as legalized slavery by Lee Williams, who was the head of the Department of Labor at the time when this program was terminated. There are also other problems. I mean, some of the things that you should be aware of is that there's resources being allocated before any of the temporary workers or any of the visas for people to legalize themselves over a period of many years. Resources allowed to imprison or detain people 27,500 aliens per day on an alien base, on an annual basis. That is part of the proposal.
27,000 people to be imprisoned
right,
a day?
Per day. Resources to detain up to that number per day on an annual basis. That means that there's an intent to round up as many people who are undocumented or suspected of being undocumented and detained for, you know, in massive camps or massive, we don't know the full impact of that. But basically, the framework that I'm trying to put forward is that there is no equal rights for immigrants or their citizen petitioners or family members to bring them here. And we're moving away from family reunification, which has been our cornerstone, and replacing it with a labor employment system to facilitate and strengthen corporate interests and allow for them for, you know, agribusiness, and many of the other corporate powers.
When you talk about the drastic change, this almost sounds to me like from a policy of give me your tired, you're poor, now it's a visa policy of give me your educated, you're affluent, and you're technically skilled to be brought in, right?
That is true, but and also part of that point system would have favor people who speak English from countries. So countries that do not have English as part of their language or part of their education system, mainly countries, people from Africa, Southeast Asia, East Asia, Mexico, and Central America, would not be favored under this system. And basically, by eliminating those family preferences that I mentioned earlier, it would prevent the people who are citizens and people who are green card holders in the future to bring in or petition for their family members in the future. So this is really a radical change.
Stan Mack, would it also be the case that the people who applied, who is the group that would have to leave for years, go back home, and then re-enter the country?
Well, there's a proposal for Z visas. They would have a period of 8 years to go to actually return to their country and start the process of applying for lawful permanent residence. So there's a group of people who are undocumented. The claim made by people who support the legislation that all 12 million people supposedly would be eligible for this. My understanding is it's really a probation or a temporary worker status because you have that long period of time before you actually can be considered for lawful status, not that you would get it. So there's that risk that you would fall off that long path to get lawful permanent residence and you would be exposed to all these abuses because part of it is you would have to maintain a job. So that would limit your ability right away from dropping off from working. You would be more susceptible to control by the employers and basically unable, I guess, to kind of fall off that. If you deviate or fall off that path, you will be unable to achieve your lawful permanent residency. And the path is such a long period. So, it's just open to
so in other words, the 12 million now who are in the country undocumented would be eligible for the Z visa. Most of them, in essence, have a temporary worker status.
It's a probationary period, and it's a temporary status of some sort as well. There's a separate temporary workers program that you mentioned earlier about the $600,000 per year. But this is an attempt to give people the opportunity down the road supposedly to get lawful permanent residence, let alone citizenship, which would take, even longer period of time.
How long would it take for an average person who is now undocumented to eventually become a citizen, by your estimate, according to this?
To become a citizen, I think at least 13 or more years, at least.
The South Carolina Senator, Lindsey Graham, said this is the last best chance we'll have as a Congress. If this somehow collapses, it will be years before you can recreate this. Do you think it should collapse?
I reject it as a starting point for any type of negotiation because it doesn't have the kind of worker protections that we need. We have to look at repealing employer sanctions as one of the starting points to create more labor law enforcement, the conditions for better labor law enforcement so that we could actually allow for people to have not just immigrant workers but all working people to have the benefits of the labor laws. And then in addition to that, we would like to see adjustment of status program. So this does not, establish, this legislation or this proposal would not meet those criteria, and it does not, of course, utilize family reunification as the cornerstone of our policy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Stan Mark is the program director of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Thank you for joining us. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Anjali Kamat, Aaron Maté, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley, to Luai Abu-Ospa, Jerome Bourgeois, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Jillian O'Connor, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, and Samantha Chambly. If you'd like to get a DVD of today's broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. We also have full transcripts there of our show, and we're a video and audio podcasting there. You can also sign up for our headlines and our news stories that we send out every day by going to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!